Baseball Nuts, and a big warm welcome to the Johnny and Josh Show, episode number 9. Number 9, the symbol of finality or completeness. Now, it's also a lucky number in Chinese culture, but we need to be more diverse in our religious effect. Therefore, written in the Bible that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, died exactly on the 9th hour when he was crucified. Sounds depressing, doesn't it? It isn't. I'll tell you why. Because the death of Christ was a symbol of the finality of his purpose on earth. He died to pave way for salvation. And I'm joined by three men who are beyond salvation. Ladies and gentlemen, the legend that is Eric the producer, JC, and Big Davey Lengel. Welcome,
hey,
boys.
Hey.
How you doing?
Hey.
Talking of salvation, it's also a very special day because a certain individual that's joining me right now is celebrating his birthday. JC, happy birthday.
I'm still kicking, fellas. Surprised every year it comes around and I'm still here.
Well, of course, what people won't know is that we had deliberately not mentioned it in any of the pre-show build-up. And literally, as Eric was saying, we're going to record, JC utters the immortal words, "Don't forget it's my birthday, boys."
Oh,
so we had it all lined up, JC. We were going to go through half the show.
So we had the dugout treatment, Josh, ready to roll.
Gotcha. So you were going to stitch me up for the whole show. That
really?
Would have been fun.
I mean, the thing was, I was going to be your stripper.
Hijinks. can we start over?
You know when you
fantastic.
Get old.
we'll do that as the add-on in one of our social
channels. Take what you can get. Take what you can get, boys.
Exactly.
Happy birthday.
Thanks for ruining your own surprise party.
I tell you what, when you're looking to do the ultimate on your birthday, you want to do what you want to do, then I'm thinking curling is at the top of that list, JC.
Ding, ding, ding. Let's get the sound effects in. Yeah, so I'm in Minnesota, and I'm playing on a World Curling Tour event. There are very few of them this year because of COVID. They have robust protocols, I will be playing in the U.S. Open of Curling.
And you've got to go off to do that today or to practice for that?
Well, first game's local time, 3:30. So we have a brief practice before and then get on the ice. I haven't thrown a rock since last March, start of March. So
and
it's
you've given
a
your
while.
Broom clean, the broom's all sorted.
The broom is sorted, the shoes are ready. I'm going to slide all the way around, Gouldy.
In case you want to know what happens to retired British baseball catchers, now you know, they go curling.
Yeah. Well, I always used to joke when people asked me what position I played, I said, I play catcher, but then I went where catchers go to die, which is first base. So now I think this is the next, you know, this is nirvana. After you've died, you then go off to curling.
The first base of first base, basically.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, Mike Piazza will be your teammate soon enough, I guess.
Yep. It's interesting, you know, there's an NFL team that plays. A bunch of former NFL players play on the tour, and they were better at NFL than curling at this point, but really good athletes, a couple former All-Pro players.
Which is ironic, because you're better at curling than you were at baseball.
That's not saying anything. I mean, I'm not. And where does that leave me as a broadcaster? I know, seriously. Thanks for the present, Gouldy.
Happy birthday, buddy.
Now, the thing is, well, I'm the other resident curling expert on this podcast, but even though Josh plays better than I ever will. But he said rock, but here in the UK, you say stone. But in Canada and the US, it's rock.
I thought it was stone.
I thought it was scissors.
Okay. Hey, what about baseball?
That's the cue
that?
For moving on, I think.
Yes, okay, boys. Let's keep it going.
Let's keep it going. Right, time now for a general news roundup. Well, I said that with excitement because I knew we were going to have our very first sound effect in the history of the Johnny and Josh Show. So the most important news of all, boys, the Braves set an NL record, 29 runs in one night. Adam Duvall with his second three-home run night of the season, 9 RBIs against the Marlins, and he's on my fantasy baseball team.
Jesus.
Here we go.
Any response? No, clearly not.
No.
Pirates were, more importantly, number 21 to honor the legend that is, that always will be, Roberto Clemente.
Yeah, I mean, Roberto Clemente, one of the greatest players of any era. He was the five-tool player, great defensive player, great arm, incredible hitter, had more than 3,000 hits in his career, and unfortunately died tragically when he was trying to bring relief goods to Nicaragua following an earthquake. It was hugely heartbreaking, was beloved by everyone, and still to this day has a huge impact. Andrew McCutchen wrote recently that even though he never met Roberto Clemente, that whenever his name came up when McCutchen was with the Pirates, it would bring a big smile to everyone's faces. He was just that special type of human, as along with being a Hall of Fame baseball player.
And of course, the award that's in his name that honors baseball players that make a difference in their community.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was a person who cared about everyone and was so beloved as a result.
And I believe Yadier Molina wore number 21 in his honor. And long may that continue. Another piece of news, guys. Shane Bieber, we might as well give him his AL Cy Young Award now, won't we, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, I know we don't care about wins anymore, but he has 26% of the Indians' 26 wins. He's 7-0. He's on pace to break Gerrit Cole's strikeouts per nine innings. Right now, he's averaging over 14 strikeouts a game. And all for the price of what Gerrit Cole gets paid in about five innings. I mean, the guy is in total.
Bargain! I mean,
talk about bargain. I mean, the guy's getting a prorated salary. I guess, you know, the only question at this point is, you know, how people, you know, will feel about a Cy Young Award, you know, in a shortened season where, you know, maybe you only have 12 starts or so.
I think the bigger question is, he now the best Bieber in the world?
That is a huge question.
Hey, just when Canada apologized to the world about Celine Dion, now we're still apologizing. Now we're apologizing for Justin Bieber. So let's not mention that. All right?
That poor guy, such a great talented pitcher, and now he has to deal with this.
Okay, guys. Well, some sad news to round up this week's news roundup, and that is that we've lost yet another baseball legend this week. And we will be talking more on this a little later in the show as we discuss the stolen base legacy that was Lou Brock, who so sadly left the world this week. But we'll be talking more about that later on. But time now for Eric's trivia.
It is time for the Eric Stumper, indeed. Now we're going to talk about not the 40-40 club, which is 40 home runs and 40 stolen bases in one season. Only four people have done that. We're going to talk about the 2020-2020 club. Hang on, 2020-2020 club. Can you name me the last player to have hit 20 doubles, 20 triples, 20 home runs, and stolen 20 stolen bases in one season?
Ow.
I don't think it'll happen this season. Nor will the 40-40 club. That won't happen this 60-game season.
Okay.
So we're looking at the 2020-2020 club. Who was the last player to have accomplished that? Was it A, Jimmy Rollins? Was it B, Curtis Granderson? Or was it C, Ichiro?
Ichiro's back! Ichiro!
Have we had one yet without Ichiro?
Well, obviously pitching ones.
Yeah. It would have been great if he was in there, though. Give us a better chance of actually getting one right.
So to reiterate, the last player to have hit 20 doubles, 20 triples, 20 home runs, stolen 20 stolen bases in one season was either A, Jimmy Rollins, B, Curtis Granderson, or C, Ichiro. And that's my answer later on in the show.
Do you know what is so depressing about these trivia questions, guys? Is every time Eric asks them, before he gives us the options, I'm thinking, well, it may be him. And I come up with a list of two or three names, and none of them are ever in the three options. I don't find a single one. That's how far off the pace I am.
So, all right, moving on.
Okay, right. Well, it's strike number one. It's leadoff batter, and it's the story of the New York Yankees, or should I call them the New York Tankies?
Ooh,
and for
so
most
rude.
Baseball Ooh. Neutrals, this will, of course, be a very popular story. Start of the season 16-6, Dave.
Yeah.
And yet there's a real danger they're going to finish sub 500. They're one game above 500 at the moment. They were lucky last night's game was postponed against the Baltimore Orioles. We're recording this on Friday the 11th. The big question is it boon to bust in Yankee Land? Do you like that? Do you like what I've done there?
I'll give it to you.
Is the evil empire crumbling?
Absolutely. Dave, what do you think? What's happening to your neighbors?
I don't know if it's crumbling, but there's definitely a panic here in New York. I mean, we're talking about a team that won 103 games last year, in a year where everybody got hurt and everybody stepped up. They get within a game of the World Series, and they go out and they want to put the icing on the cake. They take $324 million out of their pocket. They give it to Gerrit Cole, who's going to be the guy who puts the crown on the Yankees one more time. And the entitled fan base now is freaking out because they dropped 3 of 4 to the Orioles, who they own. They've had losing streaks of 7 games. They've had losing streaks of 5 games. Everybody's hurt again, but this time the cavalry has not come. And, you know, this is right about the time where you start seeing articles in the New York tabloids about what George Steinbrenner would have done if he was still alive. And you know, which manager would have flipped the spread. And instead, all you get is a pep talk in Buffalo from Brian Cashman, who takes the unusual step of flying up and trying to encourage his team. You got Luke Voit, who's the first baseman, who's had a decent year, talking about how nobody has confidence right now. They're all concerned. And, you know, they just found out that Paxton is going to not be there down the stretch. So their rotation is thin. Chapman came back from coronavirus, hasn't been himself thus far. I know he hasn't pitched much. But we don't have time for this anymore. Josh, I think, you know, when you look at the team, obviously they have a lot of injuries. Judge and Stanton and Torres was out for a little while. And Gio was out for a little while. And Sanchez has been a disaster. But if we were in a regular season, this is just the kind of stretch that they would have been able to weather. And perhaps now they won't. And to say that they're fighting for their playoff lives against the Baltimore Orioles is a shock in itself. But this would be – look, let's be honest. This is a total catastrophe. If they don't make the playoffs, it's the biggest disaster in the last 50 years for the New York Yankees, no question.
Look, Dave, I think they are going to make the playoffs, and I think your point that this is a small sample size is probably the most relevant point. The question is are they a World Series contender? They certainly are a long shot this year, even if they do make the playoffs. And you have to look forward. The way the Yankees have always been able to remain near the top is that they've bought their way into a better situation. They're trying to do it again this year when they went out and got Gerrit Cole. They have a long history of doing that throughout their whole history of trying to go out, get a great player who will then satisfy. One thing that they tried to do over the last few years is, last decade pretty much, is to also have a good farm system and really bring up players. And they had guys like Gleyber Torres, guys like Miguel Andujar, guys like Clint Frazier. But if you look at their farm system, they're now ranked 22nd out of 30 teams. And I think that's the bigger issue. It's not whether they're going to make the playoffs this year. I think they're going to get by. But whether they now have the depth to be a consistent contender the way the Dodgers have set themselves up with a really good farm system.
JC, I will pick up. Sorry, Dave. I want to pick up on the issue of this season. They face the Orioles tonight in a doubleheader. Tonight will be Friday the 11th. They've then got another 2 games against the Orioles. If they get swept 4-0, the Orioles are taking their wildcard spot and they will not make the postseason. So that dependent on what then happens after that. But this is the fact that they're going to make the postseason is not guaranteed if they can't turn around this, what is it, 5 wins in the last 20 games?
But on the flip side, Gouldy, because we're looking at such a small sample size, let's say they run off those games. All of a sudden, they're in perfectly positioned and they're comfortably within in the playoff sphere. So it really could go either way because of the number of games and the uncertainty. I think that talent-wise, even with the injuries, they're still a playoff team. Chapman in his last outing, he struck out the side. So I think that he's starting to come back. I think there's just enough in the tank to get the playoffs. I don't think they're going to be a World Series contender. But I do agree that if they don't make it, you know, people will be pulling their hair out on Fifth Avenue.
Toronto's a better team than them right now. Okay? I think there's 5 teams in the AL that's better than them. I mean, Oakland's better than them. All the teams in the Central are better, and the Rays are by far a better ball club than the Yankees.
No disagreement, but you just need to be in the top 8 teams. So
no, I understand
saying
that, but even if
they're a playoff
team,
they're just not a World Series team.
Yeah, but guys,
if they sneak in, they got to win the World Series. Nobody here cares. They got to win the World Series.
Absolutely, Dave. And let's go back to the beginning of the season. If you're a betting man, they were absolute nail on to make the World Series with the Dodgers. The bookies wouldn't consider anybody else. They were the out and out favorites. Now they're not even guaranteed to make the playoffs, let alone go on to win it.
Yeah. I mean, agreed on all that. I think when you're looking towards the future, though, the bigger question is do they have the depth of organization to be consistently competitive? This year is such an anomaly, whether they make it or not. But when you're the 22nd ranked organization when it comes to your farm system, there are big questions at hand. And I think that the Yankees need to start getting that shop in order. And I wonder how this is going to impact Brian Cashman, because he's had such an extended period of success and playoff runs, and they haven't been under 500 since 1992. So that's going to be the bigger question moving forward. I think this season, whatever happens, is an anomaly.
Josh, one thing I will say is that Cashman has been here before, and they had that season where they were kind of ready to throw in the towel, and they traded Chapman and they brought back Torres, and they made a big deal to Cleveland, and they got Frazier back, and they restocked the farm system pretty quickly. They still have those chips that next year, if they want to go and do make a move like that, they can. I think they can restock relatively quickly. Cashman's done that before.
Okay, moving on swiftly.
The Bellamy's, I have a point to make.
But you went like that with your hand. Nobody can see it, but I can, as though you were hitting the bell. So I thought,
saying, indicating you guys shut up. All I want to do is indicate to you guys, who was the last manager to be fired mid-season by the New York Yankees, and it's Bucky Dent way back in 1990.
Hey.
Wow. Bucky Dent was fired mid-season 1990, taken over by Stump Merrill, and 1990 was the worst season in the history of the New York Yankees.
That used to be the Yankees all the time. Mid-season firings, Billy Martin, Bob Lemon. Yep. It was sort of, it was a Steinbrenner regular.
Yeah, they used to be known as Watford, apparently. A little footballing reference there, which probably Dave doesn't understand.
I don't understand that. What is that? What's Watford? Is that a water gap?
Delton John's football team, mate. They fire managers more often than they have hot dinners.
Moving on to the next topic.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, can I make a suggestion, Eric? When you hit the bell, you don't say moving on at the same time, because no one can hear the bell. So hit the bell, then say moving on. Okay? Thank you. Moving on.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm just trying to keep this tight. I'm trying to keep it, because Josh has got to get off to curling. Okay. So, strike number two. Second up, and it's another goodbye, guys, and it's another heartbreaker. We lost Tom Seaver last season. We've lost last week, sorry. We've now lost Lou Brock, the Cards legend, a man who set the bar, let's face it, for stealing bases. Would you believe it, guys? Yesterday, the 10th of September, 1974, was the anniversary of Lou Brock tying and then breaking the 12-year-old single-season stolen base record when he made his 104th and 105th. Yes, read it and weep. 105 stolen bases in a single season. That would be enough to win the whole stolen bases category in fantasy baseball. That was from one player. Surely that suggests, JC, that the whole world of stolen bases is now, it's an afterthought. It doesn't have the value that it once did.
Yeah, he ended up actually getting 118 stolen bases, which still to this day is a National League record. And just a little bit of background on Lou Brock before we address the broader issue of where we are with stolen bases in Major League Baseball. Brock was one of the great players of his era, and it sort of speaks to an end of an era that we lose Tom Seaver one week and then Brock the next week. They actually faced each other more times in their career, each of them. So Tom Seaver never faced anyone more times than Lou Brock. Lou Brock never faced anyone more times than Tom Seaver. And now we've lost them both. And he was a great all-around player. He had over more than 3,000 hits in his career, hit .293 lifetime. And along with being the all-time stolen base leader until Ricky Henderson came along to surpass him, he also had double-digit home runs in seven seasons and was great all the way to the end. In his final season in 1979, which he retired, and that was the first year Ricky Henderson played in the league. Lou Brock was an all-star. So just a tremendously durable, incredible career. But he's also reflective of what we've seen in baseball over recent years, and really over a longer period than that. But from 1988 to 1900, during that period, there were numerous 23 players who had 80 or more stolen bases. Since then, there have been zero. And we've seen the stolen base die for a lot of reasons, but more than anything, we've seen a diminishment of its use because of analytics. And analytics have told us that the risk to benefit ratio for stolen bases are not worth it. That unless you can steal a base about 80% of the time, that you are going to actually score less runs if you try to steal. And to me, that's really heartbreaking because the stolen base is one of the more exciting elements to baseball. And those analytics also don't reflect other elements of what a stolen base does, which is that it puts the defense and the pitcher on edge. Pitcher has to throw over more often. They may speed up their delivery. The catcher may not frame as well because he's worried about the stolen base. The defense is thinking about how they have to move. And this is an example of where analytics dropped short sometimes in my mind, because none of that is worked into these numbers. And I really hope and wish that a team says, let's try and get some guys who can run and steal bases. But even if that happens, there are very few that were Lou Brock who could hit with power and steal. And that was the whole package. So it's a tremendous loss for the world because he was apparently a great guy, and a tremendous loss for baseball, but a reflection of where we are.
Agree on Lou Brock. I have to say about stolen bases, I think a lot of times, you know, obviously analytics have brought a new dimension to baseball. Some good, some bad. Sometimes the folks at baseball forget that we're in the entertainment business. Baseball is entertainment. It's not a company. We're not, obviously everybody wants to win. We understand that. But fans are coming to watch people run around and action and see athletic achievement on the field. It's not enough just to watch swing and a miss, home run over and over again. Even if the stolen base is no longer the most efficient, it's still an exciting play that we're missing. The hit and run is still an exciting play that we're missing. The dropping, the bunt, the squeeze plays, all that stuff is going away. And what you're left with sometimes is a very static product that even if it, you know, you're not as efficient in the way you play it, it's entertainment. We're not making widgets. But I wanted to say one thing, Josh, before we move along here. We've been here before with baseball. Some of the exact same things you just mentioned when you were talking about teams being risk averse, having to make 80%. 1920, here's a quote. Is it not time the most interesting, most thrilling of baseball players should be rescued from the slow-moving but iron-bound tendencies of the modern game, which are crushing out of its very existence? That's 1920. 1940, another time where stolen bases declined. Why risk an out to simply gain a base when most any batter on your club, if he contacts properly, can smack it over the fence? That is Joe Cronin, the former manager of the Boston Red Sox. So we've been here before.
Right, but the pendulum swings, David. And what's interesting about all the elements of the game that you are lamenting us losing is that they all involve speed, right? You know, the hit and run is about speed. One of the most exciting plays in baseball, a lot of people have said that we don't see a ton of, and this relates to Eric's question, are triples. You know, the ability to go around the bases where the ball's still in play and get all the way to third base. Usually the ball is, you know, somewhere in the, you know, in the outfield, but like close to the infield when the runner's turning around second and you have that moment where you hold your breath whether there's going to be a play at third. And those eras that you were talking about were periods where the home run wasn't as emphasized. The pendulum has swung really far towards launch angle and home runs. We need to swing it back towards the athleticism of the game and the excitement that speed brings to it.
Guys, Richard Swan got involved in this debate. He's mentioned on our Twitter page that at Johnny and Josh, by the way, the sad passing of Lou Brock, and said that it's particularly upsetting if you're a Cubs fan because basically it was the Cubs that traded him to their obvious divisional rivals. And it does beg the question, because I think Tom Seaver could have been a Brave, how, you know, you make a trade where you think it's a good trade and you end up giving away a guy who almost becomes, you know, a Hall of Famer, or does become a Hall of Famer.
But this was considered one of the most lopsided trades in the history of baseball. It was in 1964, and he was traded with Jack Spring and Paul Toth for Ernie Broglio, Doug Clemens, and Bobby Shantz. Now, Shantz had had a good career, but he only played one more season. And it is up there with one of the bad trades with Milt Pappas for Frank Robinson when the Reds and the Orioles swapped those players. So this trade is actually more infamous for that and sort of spoke to the Cubs' pathos that, you know, they couldn't get anything right that they got rid of them. So
well, you mentioned
this is more than just a good play. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, Jesse. You mentioned Broglio, who was in the trade. He posted a 5.40 ERA in the three seasons that he pitched for the Cubs. Last major league appearance was in 66. So absolutely no value there. And you've got a guy at the beginning of a career. I think what makes me laugh, the Cardinals manager, Johnny Keene, said of Lou Brock, none of us expected to see him develop so fast. And I think, obviously, he caught everybody by surprise.
But that's also a reminder. It's a reminder how athleticism plays. There's a great quote about baseball, which speed never gets into a slump. And Lou Brock had it in spades. I mean, he was a guy who could run, and he was always going to bring that. And I think what he showed was that he was more than that. Not only a great human being, but also a great hitter.
A great loss to baseball.
One more thing about the Lou Brock is, of course, he's known for his base stealing. But you think about his – you need to be agile with a bat to get on base in the first place. And the three World Series that he played in, he batted a grand total of .391.
Wow.
That's to say, yeah.
And won two World Series crowns.
And won two World Series.
67, yeah.
And in six All-Star games, he batted .375. So, you know, his bat also did the talking as well as his running. And one more thing about the demise of base stealing in management and in baseball today. Of course, you go back to 2004. Dave Roberts doesn't steal in that game four. There's no Red Sox in World Series. There you go. Moving on.
Okay, strike number three. I'm loving this. Miggy, don't lose that number on your shirt. We're obviously referring to, but I'm loving the line. Well done, Eric. You came up with that one.
Oh, yeah.
Who needs a script writer? Got to give you the credit, buddy. And I am, of course, referring to Miguel Yajure, who wore number 89 last week on his debut, which was the last unused number in MLB. What a story.
It's incredible because at the beginning of this season, there were three unused available numbers in Major League Baseball that had never been worn on any roster, any team in the history of baseball. And they were 89, wore by Miguel Yajure, 86, and 92. And all those three were taken up this season in this crazy 60-game season. Usually high numbers are reserved for spring training invitees or prospects at spring training. And rarely do you ever see a player coming over with their number 89 or high numbers, pretty much used to indicate.
It's embarrassing.
Yeah, it used to indicate an embarrassment. It's like, what are you doing here? You should be in the big leagues. You should be back in the minors or at spring training. And but now in this day and age of players want, like Aaron Judge wanting to wear number 99 and
expressing themselves.
But did you know which sport was the first to actually don numbers on their uniforms?
Cricket.
Football.
Australian rules football.
Australian rules football, correct. Aussie rules football. And back, allegedly in 1903, there was a recorded photograph of an Aussie rules game of players wearing numbers on the jerseys. And in football here in the UK, guess which team was the first in the FA to wear numbers on their jerseys?
Man United.
Not Chelsea.
County. Chelsea. Look at that. The Chelsea supporter didn't know that. In 1928, Stamford Bridge.
They were going to lose that one. No,
they were playing
nice
against.
I'm knowing you, Johnny.
Exactly.
Chelsea TV fired me years ago.
But come on, Johnny, this was in 1928. You must have been at that game.
Johnny, preparation.
Very funny. Yeah.
It's your 10th anniversary, Goldie.
So basically, 1928, Chelsea, the first team, against a team called Swansea Town, not City.
Oh.
1928. Okay. So there you go.
What's interesting about numbers in baseball is that in 1916, the Cleveland Indians tried to float it as a part of their uniform. They put it on their jerseys, and they were panned so badly that they ditched it after a few weeks. And it wasn't until the New York Yankees, the vaunted Yankees, decided to use it, put it on the back of their uniforms, and use it to describe what position in the batting lineup you were in, that it became something that was popular. And that's why Babe Ruth was number three, he batted third, and Lou Gehrig was number four, he batted fourth. In the years after that, a guy named Warren Giles, who ended up going to the Hall of Fame, he was a GM for the Cincinnati Reds. And in the National League, he started this practice that catchers would have numbers in the single digits, that infielders would have numbers in the tens, and that outfielders would have numbers in the 20s, like Roberto Clemente was 21, and that pitchers would be above that number, but within a realistic realm. And that ended up moving aside, David, as you sort of pushed aside, players wanted to start choosing their own numbers. And a personal story from that, to speak to how players start to see it as sort of an opportunity to be a part or an extension of themselves, is I represented a player named Gift Ngope, who was the first African player ever make it to the major leagues. And when he first came to spring training, he was given number 61. He gets called up to the majors and he called me and he's like, I have an option now to use a lower number, a number that's probably more readily known. But I was 61 when I came up. What do you think? Should I change? Should I go to a lower number? And I said, look, if you love that number and it reflects your first taste of Major League Baseball, stick with it. And he kept it when he was with the Pirates and then with the Blue Jays.
And I love that story. And I definitely would have kept 61 because, as you know, that was the year I was born. So that's a number I could relate to. But I'm asking you the question now, JC, because this is totally new to me. So you get given that number when you're in the minor leagues. So then when you get called up to the show, you then get a choice of a free number that perhaps is a lower number. That's how it's been working for recent years.
Yeah, when you so in spring training, you have so many players there. So you have to give multiple numbers. They actually have multiple players who have the same number during spring training. And then when you come back, you obviously have a smaller roster, so you have more options. But what's changing now, right, is that so many teams are retiring numbers. Every yeah. single digit number with the Yankees is retired except for zero. So you're now having a limited number of options as to the numbers you can have. And that's another reason that are pushing the numbers up higher.
And I appreciate there's practicality issues here, but I love that. I love that whole concept of retiring a number to honor a true legend of the game and have those numbers up in the stadium. That's a part of baseball that I absolutely love.
Yeah, I agree. And to me, it was really special. I was number 28 in high school and then 8 in college. And I always wanted the 8 in my number. And I can't explain why, but it sort of becomes part, not your legacy.
It's your Chinese. Sort of, and it's lucky.
I needed all the luck I could get on the baseball diamond glory. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. And obviously you think back as well in football terms and how the numbers are issued. And if I can draw a parallel, guys, you know, there are certain teams and certain places where having the number 9 is just the be all and the end all. That's the classic English center forward number that so many players, even in the modern era, aspire to. And that's used apparently as part of the bargaining that goes on when you're trying to draw a player from, you know, a big name player to your club, is making them the offer of a number that they really want. So it gets almost incorporated into their contract deals.
Well, Adrian Beltre, that was in his contract. When he went to the Rangers, he wanted, I believe it was 29, and he wanted to keep that number, and he made it a contractual agreement. Ricky Henderson, when he went to the Blue Jays, paid $25,000 to get the number that he wanted.
Is that right?
And the other story that's even better story is AJ Burnett set up a college fund for a player in order to get the number from that player for that player's daughter.
It didn't help.
Oh, wow. Oh, Dave, don't ruin what is a great story. It's a great gesture.
Hey, John, I did a little bit of research. Here are the 10 most famous jerseys in sports, jersey numbers in sports. Brett Favre, Gretzky, Peyton Manning, which I don't really buy, Babe Ruth, of course, Jackie Robinson, Michael Jordan, and two on that list, Richard Petty and Dale Earnhardt.
Hank Aaron not 44?
Dale Earnhardt.
Reggie Jackson.
I love 44.
Yeah, no, exactly. But by the way, Ty Cobb never had his number retired because he didn't wear one in that era.
Don't you always feel bad for like Christy Mathewson and John McGraw and all those guys out in San Francisco?
Walter Johnson.
They have that NY up there, you know, because they didn't have uniform numbers. I always feel bad for those guys.
Exactly.
Feel bad for Ty Cobb, given his reputation.
Not Ty Cobb, but, you know, for those Giants who didn't ever got, you know, numbers to have.
Going back to Football Association. West Ham United, you know, we don't see retired numbers in football here in the UK in the FA. But in West Ham United, it's just an unwritten rule that you just do not wear the number 6. Any defender or back, just, you know, out of respect, you just don't wear number 6, but you don't see
Is
the number
right?
6 retired.
Is that right, Eric?
No one wears number 6 just out of respect, but you don't, it's not officially retired. It's just pick any number you want.
Numbers really matter, because I saw at West Ham, right? I think it was Bauer. They had the shop was selling one number, and people had bought that number for this year. And then he changed his number after that, and people were going crazy because they were like, "I need to have the same number that the player is wearing. You know, I don't want this jersey where it's the wrong number."
Exactly. Well, moving on.
That's the shambles that is West Ham Football Club.
But oi.
Hey now. Steady.
Okay, well, this, as you know, guys, at this stage of the program is normally reserved for our interview. We don't have an interview this week, which means it's time for the seventh inning stretch. Stretch.
And it's nice to hear organ music again. There we go.
Isn't it just? We're introducing, as you can see now, we're beginning to blow the budget. This is in celebration of your birthday, JC. We've decided just to give a slightly more professional edge, which
the money we would have spent on a cake was now spent on sound effects.
I was asked to chip in for my birthday present, which was sound effects.
Well, and we also
allocation of resources.
Well, the reason we couldn't have a cake was we would have needed all those candles, and we couldn't get a fire certificate for that. So,
Goldie, you're exactly 10 years older than me. What does that say?
Oh, it says I look really well for my age. Okay, moving on.
Clapping in case radio land.
Zarek, what's the baseball book of the week?
The baseball book of the week this week is actually a trilogy, but I only have two of them. But it's
now I know what to get you for your next birthday.
Can't afford the third one. Or what
it's Seth Swirsky. Who? Seth Swirsky is sort of famous for being a songwriter, but not really. He's just written a few like obscure songs for Air Supply and the Go-Go's and Olivia Newton-John, but nothing that's really. I think he didn't win any Grammys. He's never gone platinum. But what he does do is collect baseball memorabilia, and he also writes letters. Yes, letters. Remember that thing that you put into a mailbox and put a stamp on it? He wrote letters with pens and something called paper. He would actually write letters to Major League Baseball players, former legends, people associated with baseball, or people like Walter Cronkite or the son of Martin Luther King, and just ask him baseball questions via letters. And so he compiled one of them is Every Pitcher Still Tells a Story. See what he did there? Every Pitcher Tells a Story. He wrote to as many baseball pitchers as he could, and they all write back, pen and paper, with a stamp. And another one was Something to Write Home About, with a home plate on the cover. See what they did there? Yeah. Something to write home about. And he'd write letters to like as many people as possible, see who would write a letter, and he'd actually take a photograph of the letter and show exactly what they wrote back. And it'd be like the most innocuous, things like asking Martin Luther King's son. There's a famous picture of him playing baseball with his son, like a father and dad would do in Field of Dreams. Just ask him, hey, look, what was your dad like, as a baseball? Who was he a fan of? Or did he ever want to play baseball? And his son would write a very eloquent letter back to Seth Swirsky, and he'd publish it and print it, and it's just a collection of books that I think everyone should read. It's fascinating.
Can I make an observation?
I wonder who has the best handwriting.
Can I make an observation here, guys? So, Eric, this is the baseball book of the week on the Johnny and Josh show. This is a man who basically has written to some people. They've sent letters back, which he takes a photo of, puts it in the book, Bob's your uncle. Josh spends years researching and scripting a proper book with his own words, with his own grammar, and you don't give him any love, not even on his birthday.
Time for the movie of the week now.
There's a single solitary tear coming down my eye now.
This is too bad. This is audio.
My question, though, for you, Eric, is could you do that book today? Because I don't think players would write back in the way.
That's the thing. And I don't think they even email back.
They wouldn't
back.
Write back. Right.
No, something to tweet about home. It doesn't have the same ring to it, or something to Facebook home about,
And are there any responses, Eric, that are worth mentioning that were hugely entertaining? Any sort
of there's one with Tom Seaver. I'm not going to go through them all, but everyone is as fascinating as the previous one. My favorite one is with Walter Cronkite, and Walter Cronkite saying how I wish he had more time to go to baseball games. And Walter Cronkite, of course, the famous broadcaster from the 60s and 70s and retired.
So
in
this is a perfect toilet book. Do you know what I mean by that? When you got a little pile of books.
Yes,
that's the genre I wrote in, Goldie.
That's where all your books are, Josh, in my toilet, as we speak.
And that's where they're best read.
As
Some
well
of
as
us have never gone to the bathroom, so it's hard to say.
And especially if you run out of toilet paper. Now,
Family show.
Ouch.
The family show, yes. Baseball movie of the week. Again, like I always say, I always try to pick films that are not so obvious. The obscure ones, people never either heard of or go, oh yeah, that film, I haven't seen that in ages. And the one that I haven't seen in ages, and I'm wondering if it still stands the test of time, is a film from 1973 starring young Robert De Niro. Yes, this is before Taxi Driver. Robert De Niro playing a catcher with special needs who actually plays for a fictional team called the New York Mammoths, it's actually filmed in Yankee Stadium and Shea Stadium and actual baseball stadiums. Michael Moriarty actually, I think, does a very good performance as the pitcher and the friend of Robert De Niro he looks after during this. But they actually wear New York Yankees uniforms, but with the NY slightly altered, so it's not, you know, a copyright infringement kind of
like
thing.
The Baseball Furies and Warriors.
Yeah, you should name the movie called.
But Eric, you haven't told us the movie name. Slow, what's the movie
exactly
called?
If I wasn't interrupted, you'd hear it right slow now. It is the name of the movie is Bang the Drum Slowly. Bang the Drum Slowly. Not Bang the Drum Slowly. Bang the Drum Slowly.
Slowly is the word right now.
Chippy here.
Sorry. Only because Josh ruined his own surprise party. That's why.
He's still upset. He's very upset about that.
We're upset.
I remember seeing it ages ago. I remember thinking, yeah, that's a pretty good movie. And then when I mentioned to Josh just before we started recording, he said, continue.
Bad. Really slow. It really had the 1970s aesthetic that like kind of goes nowhere, and the soundtrack was bad. And it's, to be honest, a really depressing movie that sort of adds to it. Okay. Yeah, I was not a fan of that movie. I like Michael Moriarty, though.
Yeah, he did a solid performance.
And De Niro did some work, some decent work, too. So
congratulations, Eric. You've chosen a movie on Josh's birthday that is depressing that and bad. Okay, it's a double double.
It's reflective of your special day, exactly.
It was shot in 73. Or 72, two, which means it would have been, one of the last non-baseball events in Old Yankee Stadium before it was renovated. So I would imagine you'd get some pretty good looks at
Old Yankee Stadium
looked
like.
At Old Yankee Stadium. So
they had
a
lot of wide shots from up high where they have people swinging and hitting, and they go into the clubhouse.
But if anything, I'd say just see it to see young Robert De Niro in his early days kind of thing. But
guys, I've just got the movie up on my computer, and I must submit the photo of Robert De Niro. I mean, he is young. Indicative of how good a movie it was, the budget, $1 million. $1 million. I think that tells its own story. You say, Gully, have you got a comment on this movie? No, never seen it, never heard of it.
There you go. Moving on to, Johnny will appreciate this one, because in the past few episodes, we've talked about MASH and we talked about Cheers. And what does those two TV shows have in common? They both had writers who went on to make Frasier. Frasier, which is another classic sitcom from the 90s, cusping into the noughties.
Was it Larry Gelbart? Who was the one who went on?
Kevin Levine, Thad Mumford, did a sort of bit of a crossover kind of thing.
Nice.
Thad Mumford, by the way, who wrote episodes for MASH and Cheers and Frasier. He was a ball boy at Yankee Stadium. Ooh. And the thing about those writers, Larry Gelbart, Burt Metcalf, who is affiliated with you, Josh, they're all baseball fans.
My cousin.
That too.
That's a very strong affiliation.
They're all baseball fans, so they always try to sneak in baseball references, cameos from baseball players kind of thing. But in Frasier, because Niles Crane and Frasier Crane are such, sports Luddites, they're too cultured for sports kind of thing. They know nothing about sports. And Sam Malone makes a cameo appearance because he comes over in one of the episodes because he's been hired as coach for the Seattle Mariners. Of course, Frasier's being set in Seattle. But I was disappointed that there weren't enough cameos by Mariners or more of them going to the Kingdom at the time kind of thing. But they reference it, but the father, Martin Crane, he's a huge Mariners fan. There's one episode where he's about to go to a game with the Mariners with a friend of his, and Niles goes, "Oh yeah, so there's one thing I know about baseball. No, Nanette was a Broadway play written to," and then they just sort of wax lyrical about Broadway plays instead of talking about baseball.
Right, but you should explain what the connection is to Nanette to baseball, though. People wouldn't necessarily know.
That's right. But I didn't want to leave any spoilers, but those who don't know, Nanette was a Broadway play written by the owner of the Red Sox.
Wow.
Yeah, he funded it. He funded it.
Sorry, I beg your pardon. He needed the money.
Nice.
That's right.
This is an apocryphal story, but a well-versed apocryphal story that he needed the money to pay for Nonet, so that's the reason why he sold Babe Ruth to the Yankees. It's actually not really true, but it's a popular fun
but
story.
But it sounds great.
Yeah. That's right.
It's been debunked, but it is a great story.
By the way, we can't go leave Frasier behind without mentioning that in 1997 there was a softball episode.
I forgot about that one. Yes.
Yes, but as we know, Frasier was definitely much too cultured. He was like George Plimpton without the sports.
For my money, guys, I would say top three all time sitcom.
It does rank it. When you see an old episode or a rerun of Frasier, you do forget how good that show was. I did think it did jump the shark when Daphne and Niles got married.
Oh, absolutely, 100%. Because that was where the humor came from, was that relationship or the unfulfilled relationship. But it's like anything, the minute they get together in any show, the minute the love interests get together, it sort of loses the spark, it loses the edge.
Good show, Goldie, top three, no way that's top three.
Yeah, Goldie, you said on social media, I saw that you said that MASH and Cheers were two of your three favorite U.S. sitcoms. Is Frasier the third one, or what's the third one?
It is, okay. Absolutely, 100%. I mean, obviously, the fact that Kramer's is in two of them, and obviously has an influence, because I just love the characters, I love the chemistry. For me, all TV, whether it's a sports show, is about chemistry. If it works, it works, and it's not about ticking boxes. It's about talent and chemistry, and it just works. I think the writing's obviously brilliant. It's so intelligent, but the chemistry of the characters is what makes it matter.
So we're a work in progress then.
Yes. Moving on now, because we're now going to see how dumb these guys are, because we're going to do the answer to the trivia question. To reiterate what I asked you, is what is an impressive feat of baseball performance is the 2020 club. Wait, 2020 is four of them. The last player to have hit 20 doubles, 20 triples, 20 home runs, and stolen 20 bases in one season, not an easy feat to do, was whom? Was it A, Jimmy Rollins, B, Curtis Granderson, or C, Ichiro?
Go with Jimmy Rollins.
Josh is going to go with Jimmy Rollins.
Dave?
I would go definitely with Jimmy Rollins.
Guys, we keep doing this, we're going to end up again.
Because Jimmy Rollins is the only guy here
splitting it right, so someone's okay, right.
No, he was good with the triple. I don't know what to say.
I'm going with Curtis. I'm going with Curtis because I love him. He was a great man. We had a relationship.
Oh, my God, it's
going
to be Ichiro.
Eric's laughing. It's going to be Ichiro.
It's going to be Ichiro. Oh,
Jesus. The interesting thing is that, because did I put Ichiro in as a red herring? Or did I?
Tell us. You don't need to ask the question.
Tell you what. I was going to try to trick you guys because it's actually not a trick question. But the answer to this, there's only one wrong answer.
Is it Jimmy Rollins?
two of these players did it on the same year in 2007. Okay. And they were Jimmy Rollins and Curtis Granderson.
Yeah! Wow! We're all right!
They both accomplished that feat together in 2007. And no one's done it since.
That's my birthday gift.
There you
just
go.
Willed that to happen.
I was so hoping all of you go for Ichiro.
Can I just bore you for 1 second? Because I was obsessed with the triple when I was younger. And the triple is the most amazing record because it's like a dead ball record. The person who owns the record, Chief Wilson, 36 triples in 1912. If you want to find somebody who's in the remotely modern era, you have to go into like in the 50s. 21 triples, Lance Johnson, 1996, tied for 53rd.
Think about how hard it is in modern stadiums, right? We used to have these wide open expanses. I mean, it was like Yellowstone National Park.
The caverns.
And so if you hit it in the right place, it was going to roll for miles.
There we go. Well done, gentlemen. All of you go away. You had two out of three chances to get that, so it's not. Don't start patting yourself on the back. Moving on, because no. I'm sorry.
Can I make a comment, Eric? I just want to make one very quick comment.
20
just,
seconds.
If Dave is obsessed with a triple, why are you not even more obsessed with the inside the stadium home run? Trey Turner got one the other night.
It's called inside the park home run.
Sorry, inside the park.
Inside the stadium home run.
Yeah, that was the English version.
Did you see that at cinema? Do you go to the cinema to see the inside the? The stadium home run.
I'll just answer that quickly. I just, you know, inside the park home run more of a wonderfully fun fluke than a real part of baseball. Triple is legit.
Oh, harsh.
Anyways,
there's nothing fluke about pace.
Okay. Enough about the inside the pitch home run. So, moving on, because apparently the postman has been to the door, Johnny.
It has indeed. It has indeed. And as always, many thanks for getting in touch, guys. This is on Facebook. You can reach us on Twitter, at Johnny and Josh, or indeed on Instagram. Interestingly, we don't seem to be getting much traffic through Instagram. So if you are into Insta, then do get in touch. I'm going to focus, first of all, on Facebook. And this is a good question. We always get a question every week from Edward Ditchfield. And I'm going to focus on Edward this week because I love this question. He said, it's a real bugbear for me, the draft. I get it why it was brought in the first place. Stop teams like the Yankees hoovering up all the prospects, but is it still fit for purpose? JC, this is what he says. Effectively, it rewards mediocrity. As in a league without relegation, if you can't make the playoffs, it's better to finish last or as badly as possible to get a better draft position. Secondly, the best young players end up in the worst teams. As we know, it takes longer for a baseball player to properly develop. Doesn't it risk permanently damaging those players by pushing them for too much too soon, surrounded by weak players? Really good points he makes. What's your thoughts?
I mean, it is very interesting. Obviously, there's been a lot of discussion over the last handful of years about teams tanking to try and improve their draft position. I personally think that the draft is good because it creates a certain level of parity within the sport. It gives teams an opportunity to sort of move up, especially if you're a team that are lower on finances. So yep. It gives you that opportunity. There's certainly pressure. I mean, there's no doubt about it. There have been history of players being brought straight to the major leagues on weaker clubs as a draw. Not even just because they were good, but because they were supposed to be a phenom. But I think that more and more teams are disciplined about that sort of thing, and they sort of try and wait for the right time. In fact, I think it's the opposite, that a lot of teams now will hold players back so that they can control them longer in the major leagues and wait until they have that critical mass of talent in order to compete. So I'm not as worried about that drive as much. In fact, I think if I'm a player who is young, I'd rather be on a bad team because you're going to get all the more chances, because baseball is a roulette wheel when it comes to talent. Even if you're a number one pick, you never know if you're going to get there. So I'm a fan of the draft. I do think that there might be efforts to try and avoid the tanking piece in order to get a better draft pick. But beyond that, I think it's a good piece of the game.
We have to lose the tanking somehow. We have to figure out some kind of scheme because it is pretty disgraceful.
Well, extended playoffs, more teams involved, more teams therefore playing to stay in the playoff hunt. There's an answer. We move on. Andy Kershaw, good question. Again, Dave, your thoughts on this. Milwaukee scores 7 in the last 3 innings on their way to a 19-0 win. Atlanta scores 7, last 4 innings, 29-9 game. St. Louis scores 5 in the last 4 innings on their way to a 16-2
win. Throw Adam.
Et cetera, et cetera. Is this, this has all happened in the last 3 weeks, buddy. Is it a statistical anomaly? To be clear, Andy's question is, are teams no longer going easy in what are clearly blowouts? So a little bit of a change and a move away from one of those unwritten rules where you take your foot off the pedal rather than grind them into the dirt.
A little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. It is a little bit of a statistical anomaly. But the as we know, pitching is in demand right now. There's a lot of junk out there, and a lot of junk is coming out in late innings. And I think that's why we're seeing some teams really really swinging to the fences late.
The Detroit Tigers had a position player, Merritt, who went out to pitch when it was already 15-0. I mean, that's it.
Yeah, and that's cute when it doesn't happen that often. It's happening way too often.
Moving forward. There's a rule now sort of preventing that. And only in blowouts. You can't bring in a positional player unless they are designated as a pitcher position player. So there are efforts to affect that.
Keep it up.
One more letter.
Okay, I'm going to go to Twitter. Anthony J. at Jelly Road 7. Can we get a small explanation, guys, of baseball cards? Are they still a thing? Is there a game to be played with them? Or are they just purely for collecting? And Anthony mentions this because apparently a few weeks ago, Mike Trout rookie card sold for $3.95 million at auction. Apparently it was number one of one. I'm assuming it had to be for that sort of money.
It's really interesting how that business has changed. So when I was a kid, David, I'm sure Eric as well too, we all collected baseball cards. I think I mentioned that I have a pretty robust collection. It was such a meaningful thing to get the players that you like. What's changed now is that organizations like Topps are trying to do specialty cards on the fly. So they have something now called Topps Now. A player gets up to the major leagues or they hit a home run and they create a special card. There was an Anthony Fauci card when he went and it sold out in 24 hours. Wow. So they're trying to sort of create other ways to make baseball cards collectible still, because what happened was starting in the 90s is that people saw this as some sort of really great investment and it became a glut. And when you glut out the cards, they lose all their value. So baseball cards are still relevant. They're not as relevant probably as when we were kids.
What's the best Topps Now card?
This one is, Dave. This one is. Have a look at this. Anybody?
That's pretty good.
People at home can't see this, but if you do get a chance,
especially
see this
when it's that close to the camera.
Take it back? Okay. On the back of this Topps card, for those of you who obviously can't see this, it's a 5 Gulden Chetwynd TV MLB on 5 Topps card, and it says on the back, as one journalist wrote, the presenting double act of Johnny Gulden and Josh Chetwynd is an ideal combination of charm and enthusiasm (in brackets Gould) and encyclopedic knowledge (in brackets Chetwynd).
I was going to go with Bartolo Colon's home run Topps Now card.
Yeah, that's
which
a good
sold 9,000. By the way,
is that right? Well, yes. Have a look at this one. This is my personal favorite. There's Josh Chetwynd, aged about 4, in his baseball outfit. That's another
that
top card.
That's my minor league. That's minor league, buddy.
There we go.
The Zanesville Grays baseball card.
Tops
baseball
card. Just to close off the mailbag here, last time I was in Montreal, I had to go in the parents' basement and rescue my collection of base cards. I had like the entire 1988 collection, and they said, we're going to throw that in the skip kind of thing. Sorry, the dumpster, as we call it back there.
Thank you.
And
I didn't know what you meant.
And I had to rescue as many baseball cards as possible from my parents' storage container in their condominium. And that's the end of the mailbag. There we go.
There you go. I didn't mention Charlie Baldwin's question, and the reason being is that Charlie actually said, could you plug in-play runs on your show? They're going to be streaming on both Sunday the 20th of September and Sunday the 27th of September from 6 p.m. UK time. Guys, if you haven't checked out in-play runs, it's a great show. It's basically it's sort of the equivalent of what Sky do with a football match, guys, and they get somebody covering individual games. You know the story. Josh, you've seen it. You've heard about it. So, guys, if you fancy that on a Sunday night coming up on the 20th or 27th, join Charlie and the team. They're going to be doing the in-play runs, which is for all true baseball enthusiasts. Thank you to everybody for getting in touch. Michael Linwood basically said on Watchdog, he said, not sure if it's logistically possible, but how about a Johnny and Josh watch-along next time there's a game on YouTube? They want to recreate the Channel 5 days. And David Forrest said, seeing as Channel 5 have a deal to show Monday Night NFL on free-to-air TV for the next 3 years, what's the chances of MLB doing it? Well, I'm sure they'll do it if it's free, because at the end of the day, no one's going to pay us to do this, are they, JC? But you've got a proper job, so I think probably that's not going to happen. But anyway, thank you for getting in touch on Facebook. As always, the Johnny and Josh Show. Do subscribe, guys. It's really important that we get as many people involved in the community. And, of course, if you do want to get in touch with the show via Instagram or Twitter, it's at Johnny and Josh. But from all of us here, that is absolutely fabulous. Please remember, of course, we've got the Fantasy Baseball add-on show where James Holden tells the world how Johnny Gould is in second place in a very important and competitive fantasy baseball league and is within 2 points of the leader. It's a great story to behold, so do check that out as well. We'll be doing that every week if you're into your fantasy baseball. The man is a living legend and is the absolute guru when it comes to UK fantasy baseball. But that's it, boys. I think the last thing needs to be us maybe singing happy birthday to Josh Chetwynd.
Let's spare our listeners.
We could do that off air, guys.
Johnny, we want them to make it to the end.
That's for sure. Are you going to make your curling? Are you going to make the game?
I've got to go. My team is sitting here waiting for me to end this so we can run out right now.
Hurry hard
for sure. Yes. Get my sweep on.
Sweep it is.
Good luck with the shovel.
Absolutely. Guys, thank you as always for your company. JC, we leave the last word to you. Happy birthday, big man.
Cheers, fellas. Thanks as always. I couldn't think of anything better to do on my birthday than hang out with the three of you and then do some curling. So it's a special day for me.
Sad, sad man.
Think a little harder next time.
From us all, thanks for joining us on the Johnny and Josh Show. We wish JC the very best with the curling and a very, very special day. From us all, we'll see you this time next week.